been a consultant in industry since at least 1958.
Way back, yeah.
Who have you consulted for, and how do you think consulting fits into this whole...
Well, I think it's a very good thing for both parties, honestly. I started off consulting with DuPont, probably 58, maybe even earlier. I don't remember when I started. But I started consulting with DuPont very early. DuPont at that point had a program of signing up relatively young people who looked interesting. You know, they tended to do that. They picked up a lot of young people over the years. And I found that a very interesting thing. I obviously didn't know much about industry, so I learned a fair amount about industry as a result of that. I also, of course, developed a lot of good contacts there. I got to know Howard Simmons quite well, for instance. He's a brilliant physical organic chemist who happened to be also in Central Research when he started, eventually head of Central Research. And so I got to meet a lot of people, got exposed to a lot of different things. It made me think about things I don't always think about. That never is a bad thing. But I think what it does for them is it gives them a chance to expose stuff that otherwise is confidential. When we give a lecture, the question period is one of the important things for us. When somebody says, have you tried so-and-so? And we say, oh my God, we never tried that. That's a great idea. They can't do that. They can't go out and give talks on stuff until it's so old and uninteresting that the company is willing to let them make it public. And in the middle of their research, they really need somebody who will hear their story and say, why don't you try so-and-so, or I really don't think that proves what you think it does. And they don't have anybody who can do that. Within the company, people tend not to do that. The politics are such that you don't want to tell your supervisor you don't know quite what's going on, and you don't want to tell let a subordinate tell you something and make you look bad. So, I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. So the political structure in all these companies, perfectly sensible, but it does make it hard for them to do this stuff internally. So I find that it's very helpful for them. And there are even crazy things that I find in some of the consulting where one outfit will tell me something which is really great, and then another outfit I'll talk to in the same company will have some problem they can't solve. And I say, but you know, so-and-so has done this already. They say, oh my God, I didn't know that. You know, so, I mean, you even are just helping to get in communication back and forth, and also suggesting ideas. And also, frankly, what they get out of it is they get good contacts. I think all the companies where I have consulted, certainly DuPont, certainly Shearing Plough, where I consult now. Let's see, if we go through, there's DuPont. I'll tell you the places before you get too far off into other stuff. So DuPont I started with, then I went to Sterling Winthrop Rensselaer, and that was because by then I think we were doing, I guess it was because we were doing synthesis, but we also were doing some biochemical things related to thiamine and all that. So somebody up there picked that up. It might have been Sid Archer. I'm not sure who picked that up. And they decided to get me as a consultant there. And that was very good. So that was my first consulting in medicinal chemistry. And I consulted with them for a long time. But then Shearing Plough wanted me to consult in the steroid area, because by then we were doing a lot of steroid functionalizations, and that was stuff we knew about. And so they first asked me to consult in the steroid area, and then they asked me to consult generally in the whole thing. And Shearing Plough was 20 minutes from my house. I mean, I could go down there in the morning and do it all day, and come back at night and come back to the lab and get things straightened out, which is what I still do. And so that was very appealing. And so at that point, if I was going to be generally consulting with them, I couldn't also do another big drug company. And so I quit going with Sterling, and I went with Shearing. Then at some point, fairly early in the game, I was involved with a thing which started off as a company called Sinvar was their first name, S-Y-N-V-A-R. And it was a combination company of Syntex and Varian. And Carl Gerassi... This is in Palo Alto. Carl Gerassi called me up. He was by then, I think, organizing this thing or whatever. He asked me to be a consultant for it because essentially there was the organic part of it, to which I did, but obviously by then we were doing some computer calculations, various things. And I was a physical organic chemist, so he decided that that combination might be a good thing for them. And he asked me to help find a president for the company, a director of research. I found one of my former lab partners, Ted Ullman, who was at that point at American Cyanamid. Ted was great. Now he was the director of research of that place up until a year or so ago, and Ted was terrific. And so I then became a consultant with that operation and was with them for a very long time, right from the founding. I mean, essentially before the founding of the company, really, in a sense, helping to get it staffed, and then right up through the current. Just a year or so ago. At a certain point, Ted left, the company was bought by somebody else, they began to change who they were, I decided I didn't need all that, you know. And but I, so that was the, they, and then a few small operations that I've been involved in what, with in one
what
way
did they
another.
Finally end up producing? They I mean, Jurassic's first idea was these pheromone.
Well, he was going to do organic ferromagnets.
Yeah.
He wanted to do organic ferromagnets. The idea was he's going to take organic chemistry and the physics that the Varian people knew, and we're going to put that together in some way. And the problem with it, it was all based on a theoretical model by a guy named Bill Little, who was a physicist at Stanford, that said that there were certain structures that could be room temperature or even higher superconductors as a result of an interaction of dyes with a conducting site. I mean, what you need for a superconductor, you got to get the so-called Cooper pairs. That is, when an electron passes by, it will repel other electrons. But in superconductors, another electron is attracted. And the reason it's attracted is when the first one passes, it causes some sort of a polarization in the system, which then is attractive to a second electron. So you get this pairing business, and that's what you need to make a superconductor. So Little had this theory about how a polarizable organic dye would be able to do that, and so the thing was founded for that. But of course, you can't found a company on an untested principle, which half the physicists in the world are convinced wouldn't work. You know, so then Ted was looking around for where else could they go, and decided that the way to go was to take advantage of the ESR expertise of Varian with the organic expertise of making compounds that could be useful. And so what they did is they then went into the immunoassay business, where they would make an antibody against morphine and hang a... They would make an antibody against morphine, take an antibody against morphine, and take a morphine molecule and hang a free radical on it, a spin label, a stable radical. And if that free radical was in solution, then it tumbled rapidly, you got a relatively sharp signal. But if that thing bound to the antibody, then the signal became very broad because the whole thing didn't tumble very fast, and so then you got this big anisotropy. So that was the idea. And then it turns out if there was morphine in the test sample, it would occupy the binding site, and then the other stuff would be free, and you'd get a sharp signal. So for a good period, and during the Vietnam War, there were soldiers out there running ESR machines on the urine of the soldiers to see if there was morphine in the urine by putting this stuff in and seeing whether they got a peak in the ESR. If the peak went up, that meant the guy had the morphine in his urine. And that was where they started. And then they went off that, and the idea was, well, ESR is all very amusing, but... Well, that's very complicated, and people don't necessarily want to own an ESR machine just to analyze for things. So they went off into other areas, and they eventually were in the immunoassay business and were very successful, really founded a field of making antibodies that would bind something you wanted to test and then figuring out a way to get a signal out of that, you know.
Okay.
And that's what they did. So, and that was fun for me. And a lot of my people were there. A lot of my people went to DuPont. Physical organic chemists went to DuPont. A lot of my people went to Syntex, the Synvar thing. They eventually changed. They couldn't be Synvar anymore because somebody in Baltimore called Synthetic Varnish already had already patented Synvar or had copyrighted Synvar. So then they became Syntex. Not Syntex. They became SYVA, S-Y-V-A, Syntex Varian. And that was what they were for quite a while. And but now they've been absorbed by somebody else. So let's see. Then some small companies I've been involved with from time to time. One I'm still involved with now, actually, sort of an interesting little outfit in Princeton that's doing things. And some of these are companies that are founded by former students of mine. There was one that I was involved in California for quite a while that was founded by a former postdoc of mine. I was one in Princeton, founded by a kid I know who was a student here. Just happened not to be my student. And so these little companies are sort of fun, you know. For a while, I was involved in something. For a while, E.J. Corey and I were involved in a company where we were being paid in stock. And so every year, we had to pay the Internal Revenue Service, the so-called value of the stock. Eventually, the stock dropped to zero. So the net result of our consulting was a significant loss of funds.
Well, you did mention, and I think a Priestley address, that you consulted for GE. How did you happen to...
GM, for General Motors.
General
Motors. Well, that was an interesting case. I was sitting here quietly doing whatever I was doing. I got a phone call from a guy named Robert Frosch, who was a physicist, who had been, I think he'd taken his degree at Columbia. Anyhow, Bob Frost called me up and said, well, there's a scientific advisory board, or GM, and they would like me to join it. And my reaction was, well, I have plenty on my plate already, and I can't see why I should be interested in this. So then he outlined what was involved in the thing. And first of all, they paid an awful lot of money. And secondly, you became part of the so-called product evaluation program, in which they gave you 4 cars a year to drive around at their expense. You know, so I said, well, that sounds more interesting. And so then I asked who else was on the committee, and it turns out there, oh, God, there's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist and a lot of real, really interesting characters in this thing. So I thought, well, that's not so bad. And I talked to my wife about it, and her position is, look, General Motors is an important operation in this country. If anything you do out there can make the thing work better, then you should do it, you know? And so I did it. And I did this, I did it for 7 years. That's a sort of the canonical time. You can be on the thing for 7 years. So I did it for 7 years. And so I had 28 or so cars during that period. Nice. Which sounds like a great thing, and it's good except when you're parked in an airport and you can't remember which car you have anymore because you haven't had it long enough to know what it is. So I did a certain amount of wandering on airports trying to figure out which car could it possibly be.
Okay. You've been very active on a variety of editorial boards. Did you serve because it was a sort of a duty to the chemical community? Was it valuable to your work?
Some of it is valuable. I don't think I've done all that much editorial boards. You tend to be on huge numbers of editorial boards. The real reason we go on these boards, to tell the truth, is because you get the journal for nothing. I mean, I got this giant pile of journals over there that come rolling in, you know, with like water in a flood, and I essentially pay for almost none of them, really. And so one of the reasons you do it is for that reason. But I would say that other than that, and occasionally one meets with these boards. Mostly these boards aren't even real. I mean, most of these boards don't even really meet. But I've been on tetrahedron boards ever since I can remember, and I don't think I've ever been to any meeting of a board there. Mm-hmm. You just get stuff. I think they send you stuff. They send you stuff to referee if it's particularly a problem. Like if they're getting conflicting referee reports, would you try to help sort out which one is right, things of that sort. You do a certain amount of that. I mean, that stuff I guess you all have to do because you have to do it.
So you don't have to do a lot more reviewing than you would otherwise?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think so. I've certainly have been on boards of things where they've sent me something and I said, suddenly I don't have time to do it. I mean, it does. Mm-hmm. So I don't. That doesn't represent a serious commitment of time. That represents a serious attempt to get free journals. So it's not exactly the same.
And you, for 17 years, you served on the Board of Trustees of Rockefeller University.
Now, that was a good thing. Yeah, that was very interesting. They're right down the street, you know. I mean, it's 20 minutes to get from here to there. And that was a very interesting thing. Partly I did that because Rockefeller at one point had a pretty good history of having strong chemistry. And then they sort of fell into the doldrums. And again, I think they didn't appreciate the extent to which they needed strong chemistry even to do their so-called biomedical mission, which is what they think they have. And I got on that board in part. The first thing I did more or less was to help recruit Tom Kaiser to the play.
I was always surprised when he went there. He was a friend of mine from Chicago and Harvard.
I worked on Tom hard, and I thought, frankly, he eventually thought it was a good thing that he had done it. He really started a great thing there.
Yeah.
And he was very effective. His loss was a great loss. And so that was partly it. And frankly, partly it also was sort of fun. The board is an interesting board. You meet the kinds of people there you don't otherwise meet. I mean, I got reasonably friendly with David Rockefeller, so he invited me to things and stuff like that. You know, so that's kind of fun, you know?
Sure.
It's a different world that you live in there. It's a world in which, because I'm on that board, I keep every year, right before Christmas, getting fantastic catalogs from the major jewelers of New York about all these obviously hugely expensive jewels that they're sure I'm going to buy. Who else would be on this board? You know? So it puts you in contact with a lot of people, and some of them are actually kind of fun. But that board is very different from most boards in one important respect. We have a scientific sub-board of people who are really good scientists. I mean, the Joe Goldstein is on it, for instance, you know. There are very good people on this thing. And that board really does very serious second-guessing on all proposed appointments and promotions, and sometimes says that's a lousy idea, you shouldn't do it. Also is very much concerned with how money should be spent in terms of new areas to invest, you know, things of that kind, things that most boards don't bother with. And also we get to know the people. I mean, we actually spend a fair amount of time with the faculty themselves giving them a way to vent whatever they're concerned about.
Uh-huh.
And that most places don't do.
No.
That is great. I mean, we are scientists talking to other scientists, and they can complain about what they're complaining about. And if it sounds valid, the next thing you know, it'll be brought up at the board and something will happen. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So that was very good. I thought we were making a big difference there. And besides, as I say, the fun of dealing with the people, you know, the people who are involved in that. The Rockefeller itself is, in biology, a superb place. So that was very good. And I know a lot of the people there. And as I say, the member of the board themselves are sort of fun to deal with.
Have they replaced Tom Kaiser with somebody of...
Not really, but there is something cooking right now. I mean, I eventually reached a point at which, you know, I've been on it for, 17 years, whatever it was, a long time. I think that was really enough. But there is a candidate coming in right now who's actually very interesting, and it's not definite yet, so I really can't say for sure, but I had to have a call into the guy to find out what we can do to try to convince him to do it. I'm no longer a board member. I'm now a so-called member emeritus because at a certain point, you know, just get off these things. But I don't know how much more active I'm going to be with it. I mean, I frankly think at a certain point you should just let it go.
Right.
But it is very easy for me to do things there, and so I'll still possibly play some role in it. That was a worthwhile thing. There's no question of it. You know, it didn't take a lot of time.
Your most recent big job outside of Columbia was being president of the ACS.
Yeah.
And what prompted you to take on that particular position?
Well, you know, there's a nominating committee. Once before, they had asked me to run for it, and I hadn't done it. And I figured there were only two things could happen. One is that I could lose the election. That wouldn't be good. And the other, I could win the election. That might be even worse, you know. So that was my reaction. So therefore, I decided that it was a lose-lose situation. So I simply said no. But this time, I figured maybe it was my time to do it, especially because I thought this was a critical time in terms of dealing with the government and, frankly, also dealing with the public image of chemistry. And not to be in any way critical of it, I felt that it was important that one have a scientist that somebody at least had heard. I mean, by then I had the National Medal of Science. I mean, I had some credibility in dealing with Congress, you know. And I felt it was probably important to do that. And also dealing with the other scientific societies, I thought we had to do that. The American Physical Society doesn't do what we do. I mean, they go and they find the next Nobel Prize winner that they haven't asked yet and ask him to be president. You know, a lot of the other societies have extremely well-known scientists. And that's true in the rest of the world as well. I mean, the Royal Society of Chemistry, you look at who those people are, they're never elected. Some committee comes up and says, it's your turn, you know. And we, of course, have this wonderful democracy, but the wonderful democracy doesn't always produce extremely strong people. Sometimes it does. I mean, Linus Pauling was a president, you know, it was great. Ernest Elia was a president, it was great. But it seemed to me that it was important that I wave around this National Medal of Science thing when I had to deal with things. And so I thought it was just my time to do it. And it was a good thing to do, I think, frankly.
Okay. Did you think that during your year or the period that you were president-elect and then president, did you feel that you managed to effect changes? Certainly this book is...
Well, the book was a good thing, but it's not the only thing. I did some things in Chemical Engineering News which nobody had ever done before. Really crazy. In principle, as the president, you're allowed to write as many as 6 so-called comments in CNE News. Well, I did 5. I didn't do the 6th one because I decided, like the Navajos, I wanted to leave one flaw in the blanket, you know, so people could shoot for the 6, you know. So I didn't do 6. Well, I could have because I had another thing I did later. But I thought it was important that the president communicate with the members, and that's the way to do it. And so I did a lot of that. And a lot of the members appreciated it and said that they had not seen that much. And frankly, other guys haven't done that much, and I don't know why not. But really, the job of the president is not just to go around and give speeches in a few places. There is really an important job of communicating with the membership, and that's the way you have to do it. So I did that, and I thought that was a good thing to do. And most of the things I talked about with the members, I thought hit a chord, you know. And so that I managed to do that. And then I did some other things that I thought were very, very useful. For one thing, for instance, it turned out, if you look at the prizes that we give in the American Chemical Society, we almost always give prizes to ourselves. The only one that was different is there's a science writing award that we give to somebody who isn't necessarily a scientist. You know, we give that award. And that's all very amusing. But how come we're giving all these prizes to ourselves? Why are we not taking advantage of this prize business to do something with the friends of chemistry rather than with chemists necessarily? Because I knew by then, friends of mine were involved in the FACEB, you know, the biological thing. I knew the people in the physics community. I knew the people in the mathematics, the guys who were head of the mathematics, society. I knew these characters. And I had a feeling we were missing the ball because we were, again, you know, so parochially concerned with ourselves. And so I got the ACS to start, which they did, an award. And I forget what we call this award, but fundamentally we give this to congressmen. It's a public service award, I think is what we call it. And we did it at first. The first year I said, we got to make this, it has to be nonpartisan. So we gave one to George Brown and one to George Porter. Porter, the Republican, who had been a great friend of NIH, and George Brown, who's been a Democratic great friend of science in general, and also a guy who's always telling us how we're screwing up by not making enough of a public fuss about things, you know, not dealing enough with Congress. So we gave the first public service medal to them, and then we've gone on to give it to other congressmen. And when we do this in Washington, we get significant press. We hold the thing in the congressional offices. We get a lot of the people showing up. We have a lot of goodwill that has built up toward the American Chemical Society from the Congress, because these guys are, you know, come to these events where we give one of their fellows a medal. We tried to continue it as a bipartisan thing so that the Democrats will make sure that they show up, because they don't want to look bad in front of all the Republicans coming, none of them, you know.
Right.
So that was a very good thing. And that we will continue that. So that's a lasting legacy, which is a simple one, but gee, we should have way overdone. And as soon as I proposed it, people said, what a great idea. Why didn't we ever do that? You know? Then another thing which I have really worked on hard is the NIH itself, because NIH has a mandate to pursue health-related science, but they interpret that as with the word biomedical. And what they mean by that is they're going to do everything with cloning and biology, and it's shocking. Bernadine Healy was the head of the NIH at one point, and they put out a plan for the future. And I was by then dealing with all that. I think I was still president-elect at that point, but. They had some sort of a future in which all the drugs were going to be made by essentially genetic engineering. You know, they had no idea where drugs come from. It's bizarre, you know. So I raised hell about that, and they finally changed the book to put in the thing to call attention to that to some extent. But I continue to push that, because the chemists on site at NIH have been really quite unhappy about the status of chemistry. They're considered to be sort of useful to have around, but surely they won't make any big contribution, you know? And so I started to raise hell about that. And one of the places I did it was to write things in the NIH news magazine that gets distributed within the site about what a scandal this was and how important medicinal chemistry was and how ridiculous it was that they weren't doing it. And you can't say as an excuse, well, we're not doing it because the drug companies are doing it, because they think nothing of doing genetic engineering, although there's a whole biotechnology outfit on it. They must understand the importance of medicinal chemistry. And so I did that. But then the other thing I did, which really worked out, is I agreed to fund in part, and I think the ACS were still funding it in part, it's peanuts that we're involved in, a lecture series on site at NIH where we would bring in chemists who would give lectures that they couldn't miss. You know, Peter Durbin and people, they just couldn't afford to miss lectures by people like that. People who are, you know, Peter Schultz, Schreiber, you know, people of this sort. Bring in those people in a lecture series which would be identifiably a chemistry, health-related chemistry lecture series. And we've been doing that, and we've gotten great backing. Harold Varmus, who doesn't start off necessarily as a great enthusiast of chemistry. I mean, he's the head of NIH, you know, Paul Varmus. He was not a great enthusiast of chemistry. He's pretty much biological. But I think he has been very supportive of this thing and has shown up at a lot of them and has made some of them directors, you know, seminars and that sort of thing, which meant put the imprimatur on that everybody should show up, that kind of stuff. But that has been very helpful, and I think it made a big difference. And the one piece of evidence I have that makes some difference, whatever it's worth, is that in the president's budget, out of the administration, which must have come from Varmus at some point, the NIH part of it, they have a section about the NIH. And in that section they say, and it is important to take full cognizance of the major role that medicinal chemistry plays in the mission of the NIH. And that was a good one.
Good.
That was a real home run. Now, where it came from, God knows. We're all working on it. You know, you can't say who did what. bought. That was a thing I really thought I had to work on, and I think there's some evidence that it makes a difference, and it's important. If the guys on the site at NIH don't think chemistry is important, next thing you know, it'll show up in the grants programs, and then we'll all be dead, you know. And furthermore, right now, there are very few, if any, labs to which you would send somebody at NIH on site for a postdoc. And the companies don't recruit down there because they say there's nobody there. But that's bizarre. There should be a serious medicinal chemistry operation going on there with good people that you would send somebody to, where the companies would go down there because they know there are all these great people that they could hire. Right. I mean, it should be a real, and it should be a thing where it should be one of the stars of the place instead of just, you know. So anyhow, so with, that was another thing. I mean, you just pick up these things and try to do what you can with it. But that, I thought I got a lot done, actually. I felt good about it. I felt good about it. Yeah.
You know, worry that sometimes people go in there sort of as caretakers.
Well, that's right. Yeah, and I think it's a big mistake to do that because we have real problems and we have to deal with them. You know? Let me tell you one more thing, if I can.
Yeah, sure.
I won't do too much. One more thing I did, which I thought was important, is to, I thought it was crazy that we were lobbying Congress. Physics was lobbying Congress. Biology was lobbying Congress. But mostly what we were lobbying for is to get an increase in the science budget. We could fight with each other later.
Right.
So I initiated by contacting the head of the American Physical Society and the head of FASM and said, look, let's the three of us get together. Let's get our societies to cooperate on a program to try to get the science budget up. Then we can all battle later about who gets which share. And we did that, and we brought the mathematicians in as well. And we also brought in Neil Lane, who was at that time had NSF, to sit in with us, and we had a dinner meeting and agreed to do this. And we started this, and we decided what we would push for was a 7% annual increase in the science budget. That would be enough to double it in 10 years. And that, we thought, was a credible number. We bounced it off our people who have good congressional contracts, and they tested this out on their congressman, who said, yeah, 7%, you know, doubling in 10 years, that passes the laugh test. I mean, if you come in, let's double it in 2 years. I mean, the people just figure it's a joke. They said, that passes the laugh test. You can make a case for that one. So we did that. We started the so-called 7% solution. Eventually, over 140 scientific societies signed on to this thing, and we produced a giant, giant lobbying operation of millions of people who all had signed on to the 7% solution. And we got two congressmen to come out in favor of it, Phil Graham and Lieberman, Graham and Lieberman. And in fact, we gave them one of these awards that I talked about earlier. Graham and Lieberman came out with a 7% solution. Now, whether we're going to get that is another matter, because every year, you know, these guys have short memories. We'll see, but for a while, it worked extremely well. For a while, the NIH budget shot up, and NSF budget shot up, and the people at NSF are convinced that what we did was heroic, because they got a big increase at a time when it wasn't clear that it would happen, you know? So that's another thing, and I think that will last. I hope it will last. That is, I hope that the general sense that these scientific societies will cooperate in the most important thing, which is to get the budget up, and then they can always fight later about, you know, how come you're putting so much into that physics project, and what about my project over here? That nonsense we can do later within the agencies. So. So that, I think that was an important thing to do too, and so that was, you know, that was another thing I did during that time.
I can't imagine you're having time for anything else, but you do have outside interests and you have hobbies. And
not much. I mean, time is a big problem, of course, obviously. But of course, I'm not heavily involved in the NIH in MACS anymore. I'm not heavily involved with Rockefeller. You know, I mean, the various these things disappear.
Right.
I've gotten rid of some of the consulting, so that I'm down to pretty much hearing plow and then this small company. My outside interests are not very extensive. I would say I play golf maybe once a year to remember which end of the club to hold. I don't play tennis anymore, which is too bad. I enjoyed that, but I just haven't done it recently. I play the piano. I mean, that's my relaxation. I like to do it. I used to play fairly seriously, although in my opinion not all that wonderfully, but my music teacher thought I was good. But anyhow, I used to play serious stuff, you know, Schubert and things of that sort. But
when did you start playing the piano?
Oh, God, probably when you were 6 years old or something.
Okay.
You know, way back. Yeah. So I used to do that. But I got increasingly interested in harmony, which has a wonderful intellectual structure, and improvisational jazz, which you can do if you understand the harmonies well enough to know what to do with it. And so I do mostly that now. I play my own version of a lot of sort of standard jazz classics kind of thing. You know, mm-hmm. I sort of know what the melody is, but I invent what one does with it,
right.
sort of thing. And that's fun. I enjoy that. And I'm not bad at it, actually. I mean, to the point where, you know, I can do this without being embarrassed. And so that's not so bad.
Do you play with other people?
Or I tend not to. I have played some as an accompanist for... once I was in Yugoslavia, actually, believe it or not, at the 50th anniversary of the Serb Chemical Society, before they started doing nasty things in Kosovo. And there they had a very good woman singer, and she didn't have an accompanist, so I accompanied her, and, mm-hmm. and we performed together. That was sort of fun.
Yeah. Yeah.